Welcome to What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. Glad to have you listening to the program today. We've got a big show prepared for you. We'll be talking with Susan Myrick of the Civitas Institute and Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation, asking the question, will your vote really count in this election? Preserving election integrity, a big topic in light of what the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals did to North Carolina's election reform legislation. Also, we'll be talking to Tom Murray of the Administrative Office of the Courts in North Carolina, finding out exactly what is going on in the judicial branch of government and what are some of the needs that they're facing as far as technological advancements and budgeting and that sort of thing. So glad to have you listening to the program today. You can engage with us on Twitter at WhatMattersNC, and you can also engage with me at Mark Shiver. I want to bring you up to date quickly on the Colonial Pipeline. They are building a line that will bypass a segment of its 1.3 million barrel a day gasoline main line. That will now need federal government approval to restart. They had a spill, as you know, on September 9th, and a lot of people in North Carolina concerned about gasoline. I saw some stations yesterday where I live that were completely out. The one station in town had cars lined up out onto the highway and wrapping around the building. They have indicated that, Colonial has indicated that they have sent gasoline to Tennessee and Georgia and North Carolina. And so really we should be seeing some gasoline return here to our area pretty quickly. However, you know, it's kind of like if it's going to snow, people zoom to the store and buy up all the bread and the milk, and it may not even snow, but there's no bread and milk left. And so what you have here is people, you know, topping off and filling up containers and making it more difficult for everyone else. But I believe that according to everything that I've read, this situation with the gasoline should start to resolve itself shortly. It won't be fully back up to speed for a while, but they are trying to do a workaround. Governor McCrory saying that he is working hard with fuel suppliers to monitor and quickly replenish gasoline supplies. This according to the News and Observer. He made a statement saying that state officials are making sure, working to make sure that motorists are protected from excessive gas prices, gouging, that sort of thing. So hopefully we'll see gasoline supplies back to normal in the North Carolina area pretty quickly. Well, we've got a big show for you today, and we're going to get right to it. Thank you so much for listening to What Matters in North Carolina. Well, in keeping with our theme of talking about election integrity and asking the question, will your vote count in 2016? Our guest on What Matters in North Carolina, always a pleasure to welcome back Susan Myrick. She is the election policy analyst with the Civitas Institute. Susan, welcome back.
Thank you, Mark.
Now, of course, we all look back a few weeks ago when the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals three-judge panel struck down the entirety of North Carolina's election reform legislation in terms of voter ID and same-day registration and mandating early voting times and lengths and all of that, and really meddled in what should have been, many would argue, a legislative issue. And so North Carolina is now coming upon election day, 50 or so days out, with no voter ID legislation. And how do you think the general public will receive this? I bet you a lot of people are going to show their ID.
They very well may. I know even before voter ID became law, I worked in the County Board of Elections for several years, and that was the biggest call that we would get from people who would go to vote, and they would come home and complain that they were not asked for their ID. So most of the people in North Carolina want to show an ID to vote. They want everybody else to show an ID to vote. It's just a simple common sense thing to do.
Well, I always feel weird when I go up to that table and the person asks me my name and I give it to them and they've got that giant binder and they find my page. But I could be somebody else entirely.
Absolutely.
And it's just an odd feeling. And all of the polling says the general public overwhelmingly supports protecting the integrity of elections just by simply showing an ID. And yet the left has fought so vigorously against that. And I was thinking this morning as I was tying my shoes, thinking about our time together, the old saying, if you don't have anything to hide,
right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So if you're not doing something untoward, why are they so afraid of just simply showing an ID?
They're not afraid. They take advantage of anything they possibly can. And they err on the side of they want everyone to vote, no matter if they're eligible or not, where we err on the side of we only want eligible voters to vote.
Well, that makes sense to me.
It makes sense to me. And it makes sense to most of North Carolinians. Like you said, polling across the state and across the nation overwhelmingly supports voter photo ID in every demographic.
So in terms of protecting the integrity of our elections, what we're faced with right now, our guest Susan Myrick of the Civitas Institute, is that we're back to where we were, where people can register the same day as the election and vote.
That's right.
Now, I was thinking about this as I was driving in. So I've gone from tying my shoes to driving in. And I thought, well, I could register and vote and maybe go do that again somewhere else.
Sure.
Under a different name, sure. Possibly?
Sure. To register, to use same-day registration, all you have to do is, you don't even have to show an ID. You have to show evidence of an address. And you can do that with a sheet of paper, a copy of a utility bill or something like that. It's just really open to fraud, and the left knows that. In the last couple of general elections, thousands and thousands of people have registered to vote and voted at the same time during early voting. And when their verification card, which is mandated by law, mm-hmm. is sent to them, it gets returned undeliverable because they don't live there. And let me say this,
Wait a minute, let me stop you there.
Okay.
That's true?
That's very true.
That's incredible.
But now, the left will tell you that's because they moved.
Oh.
Well, yeah, very possibly. Or that's because they never lived there. And that's probably more possible. North Carolina, the left love to say, well, over 12 states have same-day registration to make it sound like a normal type of
right.
thing. But truly, 12 states, they do have same-day registration, but they only use it on election day. That's one day. And that's bad enough, mind you. I'm not going to say that's a good thing. North Carolina is just is joined by two other states, Ohio and Maryland, that allows it during early voting. So we have, instead of one day that these 12 smarter states than us have same-day registration, we do it for 17 days.
This just seems silly. It doesn't even seem that it makes any sense.
It doesn't make any sense. It's the liberal agenda, the radical liberal agenda. And unfortunately, people fall for it. On our side, they actually, most of the Republicans that were there when they were passing these laws voted for them because they were sold on the by being told that it would increase turnout when it definitely doesn't. When you know, that's how they sold them early voting outside of Election Day, that they said that early voting will increase turnout. Unfortunately, it doesn't. Not at all. And,
really?
And some experts believe that it diminishes turnout because it takes that excitement away from Election Day.
Hmm. Well, our guest, Susan Myrick here of the Civitas Institute. And one of the most, I mean, you could argue it's the most important cornerstones of our republic as a free nation is the right to vote.
That's right.
And I don't think that conservatives in any way want to suppress or disenfranchise anyone who is eligible to vote.
Absolutely.
And you and I have talked about this before. And I remain adamant that requesting an ID does not disenfranchise anyone because, you know, and we've heard this argument a gazillion times, you have to have an ID for just about anything you do in life.
Right. And North Carolina had those safety nets. For instance, there are some people that are old and were born, you know, somewhere that they don't have that document to show their birth date or their where they were born. The fail-safe method there is voting by mail. And less of those instances of people not having the documentation are happening, and we don't even – they didn't want to try to help those people get IDs. So if there are people without IDs, the least we could have done was help them try to get IDs. And that's something that's interesting about the left, too. They profess to be the way for the people that don't have help.
And right, the caring.
Right, the caring side. But they don't, they really don't. And they didn't even care to get those people to have an ID that will help them, you know, in society every day. Interesting that you said, will our vote count, I think is the question.
Yeah.
Just, I heard coming in this morning about 800 illegal aliens been given citizenship accidentally.
They were ready
to be deported, actually, under another name. And they gave them citizenship. That's 800 votes this year.
Oh, my goodness.
Because as soon as you get citizenship, you can vote. We can't ask for an ID. We can't ask for proof of citizenship. Will our votes count? They probably will count, but they'll probably, a lot of them, be canceled out by fraudulent voters. Ineligible voters.
Well, our guest is Susan Myrick, and we're talking about the question is, will your vote really count in the upcoming election? And we're kind of teeing off on an event that the Heritage Foundation is having today by that same name. It's called Will Your Vote Really Count? Assuring the Integrity of the American Election Process. And I talked, Susan, with Hans von Spakovsky, and we'll have that interview also on today's show. But one of the things we talked about, and you don't hear anything about this, was that in the last presidential election, so many military, their votes never got counted. They voted absentee. And how can this be? I mean, these people are fighting to preserve this right that we have to vote, and yet their votes were never counted.
For the military, that has happened almost every election. There were people out there working really hard to rectify that problem, but it seems to happen all the time. If it was another subset of voters, I assure you, it would be front and center.
Wow, that's just appalling to hear that, you know, here's some guy or woman in Afghanistan in a bunker, and they take the time to send in their vote,
right,
and it just sits in a big pile.
Right. If it gets there.
Yeah, if it gets there. Well, that's absolutely incredible. So in terms of North Carolina, and we've talked about this before, but the left is known to say and kind of laugh while they're saying it, there's no voter fraud.
Right.
But you know that there has actually been cases of voter fraud in North Carolina, real, actual cases that have actually made it to the media.
Actually, that have been documented. That's the problem with voter fraud in North Carolina. They want to cover it up so much, I think, perhaps, to give citizens a false sense of security there. But there are cases that have been discovered and reported on. For instance, Robeson County has had two elections thrown out because of the combination of same-day registration and early voting.
Thrown out.
Wow. They had to redo the elections.
Goodness.
And even the Robesonian, the newspaper from Robeson County, changed their mind and said they now understand how dangerous that duo is. And that's something for a mainstream media outlet to say that.
Oh, absolutely. And so what we don't hear about is the voter fraud that doesn't get caught. And
well, yeah, you can't. That's the essence of voter fraud is to be secret and nobody ever know it. And that's something that, you know, you can't point out.
Yeah, and the good example that we were talking about the other day is if you're cruising to the beach all by yourself and you're going 85 miles an hour on I-40.
And there's not a highway patrolman.
There's not a highway patrolman. That doesn't mean that you're not breaking the law.
That's right.
And so the fact that people have perhaps perfected the art of voting multiple times on election day and in multiple precincts.
Just because they're not caught doesn't mean they're not doing it. That's exactly right.
So in terms of what can people do? Before I ask that, though, let me go back because I want to ask this question. What can the General Assembly do? Now, they've had this election reform. Basically, Judge Schroeder at the federal level, district level, wrote a 1,000-page...
It was hundreds and hundreds of pages.
Opinion about how our North Carolina's election reform legislation was constitutional. Right. It did not discriminate. It did not disenfranchise. Yet three judges, who some would say one personally had an axe to grind, you know, accused the state of being racist and all of this. So here's the General Assembly. When they roll in January for the next long session, can they do anything? Can they try again? Can they?
Sure, they can.
Pass another law?
Sure, they can. They can start at the beginning and pass a law. I hope they do. Until they do, though, I think they can do a couple of things with the law the way it is right now. For instance, same-day registrants. They can register and vote in the 17 days leading up to the election. Require them to show an official photo ID. They're different. They've never been verified like you and I mm-hmm. and everybody else that's registered to vote now has been verified. Require that. If they don't have it, let them vote a provisional ballot, and if they don't bring their ID back in, their vote's not counted. Now, I'm not making this type of thing up.
Sure.
The states that have same-day registration during Election Day, they have these safeguards for just that because they're not ignorant and they're not silly about it. They know people will commit voter fraud. If a person is deemed inactive as a voter, if verification cards are returned undeliverable twice, you get a little I next to your name and people you're considered inactive. If you're an inactive voter and you come to vote, you should be required to show a photo ID.
Oh, absolutely.
Because most inactive voters are either dead or they've moved. So if you come in as an inactive voter and state your name and address, you should have to show an ID, and that address on your ID should match that person in the book.
Yes, absolutely.
There are several things that they can do that are simple and would help until they can get some real election reform passed.
Now, I was looking at some of the information that the Heritage Foundation will be putting out today. And I did not know this. I bet you knew this. But the U.S. Supreme Court in 2008 said that there have been flagrant examples of voter fraud that have been documented throughout this nation's history by respected historians and journalists. The instances of such fraud uncovered over the years demonstrate that not only is the risk of voter fraud real,
right,
but it could affect the outcome of a close election. Now, this is from a case, Crawford versus Marion County Election Board, and that was 2008.
That's right, and that's the big photo ID law.
Well, see, this when I read that quote, I thought, okay, maybe 1840, 1953. This is 8 years ago.
Sure.
So the highest court in the land has recognized that voter fraud is real, and yet here's the left saying, no, it's not real. But my point is that this just flies, this decision by this three-judge panel flies in the face of the reality of what the Supreme Court has said as recently as 2008.
Right. Well, the Fourth Circuit now is comparable to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco with some of the decisions they're making. They're very unreliable and almost embarrassing.
Well, it's just incredible. I always you probably leave our times together thinking that I'm just really crazy because this stuff just really blows my mind. Here's an interesting thing: types of voter fraud, impersonation at
right.
the polls. We've talked about that. False registration.
Right.
We've talked
Same
about that.
Registration.
Duplicate voting.
Right.
So this would kind of combine. You know, I could go to a precinct, and just say, you know, that I'm so and so. No ID, so I could vote there, and I could roll across town and do the same thing.
If it, you can actually, in some counties you can, when we're talking about early voting, because they're not connected. In a lot of counties, they are connected by the internet, so they could catch you doing that. But what you can do is at the end, and what is done quite often, at the end of early voting, you can go vote and then go first thing on election day and vote, and they won't catch you.
It's incredible.
Oh, until they bring your name in as an early voter. And if a good, you got to have good election workers. That's the key. And it's hard to have really good election workers because they only work once or twice a year.
Yeah.
And the laws are so crazy, you've got to have great training. And I think we're going to segue into the what else can we do? We can actually volunteer and work in the election process. The left does. And they've been doing it for a long, long time.
Yeah, you stole my question because I was going to say, what can we do? Yeah. And you're saying, so people, conservatives who may be concerned about the integrity of the election process should volunteer to work at a poll?
Absolutely. Work in one-stop voting, work in a poll for the Board of Elections, be an observer for your party, learn what the laws are, learn what to look for, and observers are wonderful people if they know those things. But you got to go in there with knowledge. You can't go in there and think you see something because the election process is very strange, and not in everyday real world. Mundane way to go. It's just very strange, and some things look different, but they're normal.
Right.
So you go in there with knowledge and know what to look for. Be an observer or be a paid worker. Even better, be a paid worker and learn the system from the inside out. That's about all we've got for 2016.
Yeah. So that's tremendous advice. Get involved.
And
really, that's
absolutely
what we always encourage
and
people
learn. Like
to
I said,
do.
If you get educated on the process and gain a lot of knowledge, that's the best way to go in there. The best way.
Well, I will certainly say that we encourage folks on this program to get involved nearly every day, whether it's in regard to one issue or another. But this is one that we would put an exclamation point after. Get involved. Be, as you said, a poll worker, a poll observer, poll watcher.
And if you see something,
let somebody know.
Report it.
Yeah.
And don't do it with just a telephone call. In the election world, you have to do it in writing and make it official. If you don't, it will go away and never be heard or seen again. So making a telephone call gets you nowhere. It doesn't get anybody anywhere.
Yeah.
With elections, you have to make it official.
Okay. Well, good advice and good information. Susan Myrick, the election policy analyst with the Civitas Institute. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
I'm
hopeful that maybe in a few months, the next time we can look at the issue of voter ID, that perhaps the General Assembly will have done something again, and that maybe this time it'll pass through the courts. But anyway, thank you so much for being
thank
our guest.
Thank you, Mark.
Our guest now on What Matters in North Carolina is Hans von Spakovsky. He is a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Hans, always a pleasure to have you back on What Matters in North Carolina.
Well, thanks for inviting me back.
You guys are having an important event called Will Your Vote Really Count? Assuring the Integrity of the American Election Process. Tell me a little bit about that Heritage Foundation event.
Sure. We're actually doing a book event. Tom Fitton, who is the head of Judicial Watch, which is really just a terrific organization in Washington, actually has a new book out about all of the work that Judicial Watch does. And for folks not familiar with the organization, you know, they've been key, for example, in getting information out about the email server of Hillary Clinton. They've also done a lot of work on voter fraud issues because they specialize in filing Freedom of Information Act requests with government officials to get copies of internal government documents and communications, and often that can reveal a lot of wrongdoing inside the government.
So you'll be talking with Tom at the event, and I notice you will also be one of the speakers along with John Fund. What is going to be the topic? I know it's talking about election integrity. Is that really what you guys are going to drill down on? And will people leave there feeling like they can trust the process, do you think?
Well, I think they're going to be a little bit worried. Like I said, you know, Tom's book, Clean House, covers many different areas, but we are going to try to concentrate on voter fraud and election integrity because, in fact, Judicial Watch has done a number of great things in that area. They filed a series of lawsuits, for example, against states like Ohio and Indiana and elsewhere over the fact that those states weren't actually cleaning up their voter rolls. You know, they weren't taking people off who have died, people who have moved away, all of which makes it easier to commit fraud. So we are going to be concentrating on that. But people should be worried about it because, in fact, look, Judicial Watch shouldn't be the organization that has to file these lawsuits. This work ought to be done by the U.S. Justice Department. You know, they've got an obligation to enforce the National Voter Registration Act, which has a provision that says states have to maintain the accuracy of their voter rolls. This administration has refused to do that. In 8 years, they haven't filed a single lawsuit of any kind against any local city, county, or state anywhere.
That's
over
incredible.
These voter rolls, and that's a real problem.
Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, it's certainly hard to believe. Hans, our concerns here in North Carolina, and we've had you on a couple of times to talk about the courts having struck down North Carolina's what many called common sense voter ID legislation. And as someone who lives here in the state, I have concerns personally about election integrity here in North Carolina. Is that something that, I should be worried about?
Yeah, you should. I mean, look, there have been cases of voter fraud in the state. There are I know several citizens groups there who have checked and have found individuals who have registered and voted both in North Carolina and other states, obviously committing fraud. And look, you've got a problem in that state of non-citizens who are registering and voting. And really, you know, with everything the courts have done, you've got no way really of detecting that.
Well, it seems, I don't know, it just seems kind of silly, Hans, that those in charge of administrating our Constitution and all of that would strike down which, things like voter ID and prohibitions against same-day registration and prohibitions against voting out of precinct. And yet these judges are, judicial activism is the way it's described, but it really makes you scratch your head at to what they're thinking, what's behind this. Do they want election fraud?
They are acting in a purely partisan political manner. They are not acting as judges. First of all, these are federal judges, and how elections are run are entirely under our Constitution within the hands of the states. And as you said, the idea, for example, that allowing somebody to vote out of their precinct, well, look, it's been a tradition in America forever. In almost every state, that you're supposed to vote in the precinct that you're assigned to. To say that that is unconstitutional or somehow discriminatory, look, there is no basis in the law for that whatsoever. Instead, what you have are biased judges who want a particular partisan political end, and they believe that this helps their particular political party, and that's why they're doing it. It's not based on the law.
Our guest is Hans von Spakovsky, excellent senior legal fellow of the Heritage Foundation. We're talking about an event they're having today. Will your vote really count? Assuring the integrity of the election, American election process. And what can people do, Hans? I mean, we're at the mercy of the courts. Is there any solution? I mean, we all are looking at the national election and, you know, the possible consequences if it goes one way or the other, the possibility existing that the next president is likely to appoint at least one, maybe three or four of the next justices. And it's very disconcerting to believe that or to think about the possibility that this could all get worse. Is there any solution that the citizenry has to come up against what seems to be the final word when it comes to these court cases?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm not going to endorse anybody for the presidential race, but I would urge everyone to think about the fact that while we face many problems, I think one of the most important issues in this presidential race is the empty seat on the U.S. Supreme Court, because right now the court is split 4-4 between four liberals who always vote that way, mostly conservatives, although Justice Kennedy, unfortunately, too often votes with the liberals. But here's the thing. The next president is going to pick who replaces Justice Scalia, and if a liberal justice is picked and there's a 5-4 liberal majority, every voter ID law in the country is going to get tossed out. All these foolish decisions made by judges about same-day registration, early voting, are going to get upheld, and it's not just in the voting area, but our Second Amendment rights, things like that, they're all going to go right out the window if there is a fifth liberal justice appointed to the court.
Well, it certainly is cause for concern, and so other than, you know, possibly trying to encourage people to consider that when they go to the polls, is there anything that the states can do? I know that Daniel Horowitz of Conservative Review is convinced that Congress can legislate the role of the courts. Is there anything, however, that states can do? I was thinking about here in North Carolina. I mean, what do we do now? They struck down the law. Do we try to write another one? You know, keep going to the drawing board? I mean, what is there any solution for states?
Well, the states have been putting up a terrifically good fight to stop this kind of behavior. While North Carolina and Texas have had bad results, other states that have fought back, like South Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee, have had good results. So I would encourage folks to keep fighting in the states over these issues. The other thing the average voter can do is, look, there are all kinds of grassroots organizations now that have sprung up that are doing things like checking the local voter registration list and finding the names of people that they on there that they know are dead or who have moved out of their neighborhoods, and they are raising Cain about that. And that kind of publicity over things like that is a big help, particularly against the media, which is constantly saying, oh, you know, there's no voter fraud, there's no problems with any of our election procedures. Well, when you know that someone moved out of your neighborhood a couple of years ago, but they have continued to vote, you know there's a problem there.
Yeah, exactly. Hans, one thing I was talking with someone about the other day was that there were a lot of, there was an accusation made, there were a lot of absentee ballots, particularly from the military, that were not counted in the last presidential election. Has there been anything done to address this and to make sure that those folks, that their votes are counted?
That, in fact, is the biggest problem. You know, the biggest source of disenfranchisement in this country is not the stuff that the media talks about. It is military voters. Now, in the last couple of years, there have been some changes made. The federal law was amended, for example, to force local officials to mail out absentee ballots that have been requested by overseas military folks at least 45 days before the election, the idea being it takes so long for the mail to get over there and back that would help. But things are still bad. The biggest problem that military folks have is they move so often that often election officials lose track of them, and that's something that this administration has not done a good job of trying to remedy that problem.
Well, we certainly have a large contingent of military here in North Carolina, so we are hoping that there will be some measure of integrity here, at least that their votes will be counted in this election. So when you come away from your event today, and folks here in our state that want to look ahead, specifically in terms of feeling like, yeah, my vote's going to count, what can people come away with to feel better about that, Hans?
Well, I tell you, make sure that you not only go vote, but you get all your family members and everyone else to vote. Because the more turnout we have, the less chance there is that folks committing fraud can change the outcomes. The other thing that I'd encourage people to do is, look, local election officials are always looking for people to actually work in the polls on election day. They're always short of personnel. It's a very long day, and the pay is not very good. But listen, if you are an election official working in your local precinct, then you've got the ability to make sure that the law is being followed and there aren't any shenanigans going on. So I would encourage people, if they've got the time, to volunteer and work in the local polling place. If you can't do that, become part of a poll watching program for a candidate or a political party. That also will be a big help.
Well, that is excellent, excellent advice, and we sure do appreciate it. Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation, thank you very much, as always, for taking time out to be our guest today on What Matters in North Carolina.
Thank you.
All right. Well, it's our pleasure to welcome to What Matters in North Carolina the Chief Legal Counsel for Government Affairs at the North Carolina Administrative Office of the Courts, and that would be none other than Tom Murray. Tom, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Mark.
And I can call you former Representative Murray. You served two terms in the North Carolina House of Representatives. You're also an attorney and a pharmacist, and you serve in the National Guard. I don't think I've seen a resume quite like yours in a long time, sir.
Well, it's a pleasure to serve the state of North Carolina in many different ways, and I'm glad to be working with good public servants like Chief Justice Mark Martin and AOC Director Judge Marion Warren. Between me, Judge Warren, and Chief Justice Martin, I think the judicial branch is heading in the right direction, it's definitely something I'm enjoying working on right now.
Well, before I make sure that I do not forget, I want to thank you for your service, not only to our state, but to our country.
Well, I appreciate that, Mark.
Well, Tom, what caught my eye was that you're fairly active in social media, and lately you've been posting about some conversations that folks that represent the judiciary have been having across the state, the Speaker's Bureau and Forum on Technology as related to the judicial branch. And so I wanted to ask you, what is this all about? Are you guys going across the state and try to bring people more aware of what's going on in the judicial branch?
Yes. When Chief Justice Martin was Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court, one of the main initiatives that he was very interested in is civics education. And we happened to be celebrating the 50th anniversary of district courts and the formation of the administrative agency for the judicial branch, the Administrative Office of the Courts, this year. There was a major unification effort back about 50 years ago. And so over the next 4 years, we had celebrations. And so I would invite folks to go visit celebrate.nccourts.org. And you can find out about just kind of the history of the North Carolina Judicial Branch. And part of that is the Speaker's Bureau that Justice and Justice Jimmy Irvin have started to offer free speakers to anybody, any civic groups, school groups. And I think it's a great opportunity for folks in primary education and civic groups to learn just a little more about the separate co-equal branch of government that is the judicial branch.
Our guest, Tom Murray of the North Carolina Administrative Office of the Courts, here on What Matters in North Carolina. Now, I think that people, Tom, don't normally think about the court system, the judicial branch, unless one of two things happens. They're either somehow immersed into that system, a speeding ticket or worse, or there's a court decision that resonates either popular with a certain group or unpopular. And so you guys are trying to bring some attention to what you guys do and what goes on every day in the court system. Is that correct?
That's correct. And I can tell you, it's really easy to pay attention to the executive branch, and it's really easy to pay attention to the legislative branch. But I think our founding fathers knew that an independent judiciary is extremely important when it comes to separation of powers. And I think as citizens, we need to be aware of that as a branch and the important role it plays in our democratic republic.
If you were to take on the role of Justice Martin, who normally gives a state of the courts message to the General Assembly early in the session, from your perspective, because you're involved in the day-to-day administration of the court system, what would you say right now is the biggest challenge the court system faces? Is it technology? Is it just straight-up funding? What would you pinpoint as one of the biggest needs that North Carolina's court system has today?
I think technological improvements is a key area that we are focusing on with the leadership of the Chief Justice. And there have been several recent initiatives that I would point to that reflects an areas of improvement for our judicial branch. We've got a great website called onlineservices.nccourts.org where you can find out about two recent initiatives. One is online collections and payment. I think in the Amazon society, you expect to be able to do a fair amount of business online. And now for folks that have probation payments or paying various different things within the judicial branch, you can make a lot of those payments online. And so I think that being able to roll that out, we've already collected almost $200 million in online collections and payments since we've rolled that out.
Wow.
Which is a pretty sizable amount of dollars. We also have a new program that's rolled out statewide earlier at the end of the summer, what is called electronic compliance and dismissal. There's a couple of traffic citations. For example, if your driver's license has expired, it's by statute, once you renew your driver's license, that infraction shall be dismissed, and it's a shall. So once you renew your license, you're not guilty of having an expired license anymore. And so there's a way that you can log on, and without having to go to the courthouse, you can get that infraction for an expired driver's license dismissed. And without practicing law, without a lot, I'll tell you that that'll keep you out of the courthouse. So that's kind of our goal, is to meet the expectation of our customers, which are the citizens of North Carolina, where if they're expecting to be able to do a fair amount of their transactions online, we want to meet them where they're at and get the right information so they can conduct business with the judicial branch without having to go to the courthouse.
Well, that sounds like it's adding a lot more convenience. I know one of the things that people really don't like to do is stand in line at the courthouse to pay a fee. This would sort of tie in, I guess, tangentially to Governor McCrory's initiative to have the Department of Motor Vehicles do as many things online as possible. And so I guess between the two branches there's a real emphasis on technology. Are there other areas of technology that we might not be aware of that's either rolling out or part of the longer range vision for the judicial system?
Absolutely. About 10 or 11 months ago, Chief Justice Martin formed the North Carolina Commission on the Administration of Law and Justice. It was one of the visions. About every 25 or 30 years, the judicial branch kind of convenes a stakeholder group and tries to make best practice decisions on how we can deliver justice better in our state. And so the North Carolina Commission on the Administration of Law and Justice has been meeting over the past 10 months. There's an interim report available on ncclj.org. And one of the key committees, there's five committees, but one of the main committees that's meeting is a technology committee that's coming up with a strategic plan for our judicial branch and case management, so that we have cases can move through the process more smoothly, and e-filing are two main areas that are coming out of that technology committee. So cases need to be managed. We don't need to have just continuance after continuance after continuance and delay and delay and delay, because we all know justice delayed is justice denied. And so case management and the ability for attorneys and litigants to file documents electronically and review opposing party documents electronically is a major focus that's coming out of that technology committee. There are other subcommittees of that commission that I think that bear mention as well. We have a civil committee, a criminal committee, public trust and confidence, and a professionalism. So there are areas that are being studied and discussed to help improve the judicial branch in all five of those committees. And I can tell you specifically an area of interest that is generating a lot of discussion deals with juvenile justice and how North Carolina treats 16 and 17-year-olds as adults. We're one of two states that still treats 16 and 17-year-olds as adults. And so that's a major topic of conversation to talk about how we can be able to raise the age of juvenile jurisdiction to 18, treat 16 and 17-year-olds like children, like 48 other states do, and talk about how we can safely roll that out through the legislative process.
Our guest is Tom Murray, and he's the Chief Legal Counsel for Governmental Affairs with the North Carolina Administrative Office of the Courts. On a personal note, Tom, I know that you're an attorney. You also served in the General Assembly, where it was part of your responsibility to consider legislation, draft legislation, and support or not support legislation, some of which may have had to do with the very branch of government that you're working for now. How has the transition been for you personally to take off that legislative branch hat and put on the cap that says, you know, Administrative Office of the Courts?
Well, when I was in the legislature, I had the pleasure of chairing the Commerce Committee in the North Carolina House of Representatives. And so I think the intersection between economic development and the business community and the judicial branch probably can't be understated. Businesses like predictability and certainty, and I think the North Carolina Business Court that's something that I worked on when I was in the General Assembly, and a great forum for businesses to get their disputes adjudicated fairly and timely. And the North Carolina Business Court is a crown jewel, not just for the judicial branch, but for the economic development side of what the North Carolina, our North Carolina government provides to the business community. And I think there are other states that are looking at the North Carolina Business Court to replicate it, and so I think that's one of the serious forms of flattery is imitation. And I think there are people looking to imitate the North Carolina Business Court, and I think that was something I enjoyed working on when I was in the legislature, and I continue to enjoy working on how we can improve the business court so that complex business litigation can be handled in a fair, timely manner.
Now, Tom, there also, correct me if I'm wrong, I can't remember if it passed or not, but there was talk last session about specific veterans courts. Am I missing something here?
That's correct. We have several veterans courts across North Carolina that are mainly funded through the Governor's Crime Commission through grant funding. And so we have one in Harnett, Cumberland, Buncombe, and I believe there are a couple more. I know I'm forgetting one. So and I apologize to anybody, and I'm not intentionally leaving any veterans court out. But it is the process of by which a specialty court comes to be is it's a way to handle situations in a way, and I think that is a little bit different than other sessions of court. And so I think a treatment-focused, getting access that some folks need, if the only reason why a person is in the courthouse is because of an addiction issue, whether that's a veteran or any other situation, I think that focus on treatment is really not a judicial function. I mean, that's healthcare.
Yeah.
So, but a recognition by the judicial branch that if we can get folks treated and end their cycle of criminal activity, then we're actually leaving society in a better place.
Now, just so I understand how this works, is that something that is under the oversight of the administrative office of the courts also?
So the way I describe AOC is we're kind of like the corporate headquarters for justice is, for all intents and purposes, our governor. So the Chief Justice is the governor of the judicial branch. He appoints a director of the administrative office of the courts, and that's Judge Marion Warren. And so we work at what I would call, like I call, the corporate headquarters for the judicial branch. And so AOC supports when a superior court judge, their computers, we handle their computer issues, their phones, scheduling of judges. We have a rotation system. And so with conferences, training, all the clerks of superior court, all the magistrates, the district attorneys are in our branch. The indigent defense and public defenders are part of us as well. So we have a pretty all-encompassing. We have 6,000 employees. Our budget is a little over $500 million.
Wow.
It's a bigger operation than most folks would think, and we have a lot of intersection with the Department of Public Safety and law enforcement. And so I think there's anything that touches the courthouse is something that the judicial branch and the AOC is involved in.
So in terms of the financial needs that the court system has, I know that Chief Justice Martin, a couple of years ago in his State of the Courts address, asked for certain things, and it looks like the budget came back significantly short of those areas. What do you think, and I'm sure this is a never-ending question, Tom, but how can the court system better make its case, you having been a member of the General Assembly, how can you guys better make your case that, hey, we really need some of this funding to bring us up to speed from a technological standpoint and to better serve the people of the state?
We received some much-needed relief in the long session for courthouse operations for juries and interpreters and just all sorts of courthouse operations. And then in the short session, judicial branch employees received a significant compensation increase, raises for judges, clerks, district attorneys, public defenders. We were very pleased at how the General Assembly treated judicial branch with regards to compensation increases for the branch. Moving forward, when we're talking about our technology needs specifically, I think the case to be made is that a dollar invested results and savings, every year, Mark, listen to this. This is one of those shocker statistics. Every year, the North Carolina Judicial Branch produces over 4 miles of paper.
Oh, my goodness.
And so if you know, the Administrative Office of the Courts, our office building is over close to the RBC PNC Center, where the Carolina Hurricanes play hockey. And so we produce enough paper to go from our office to Jones Street.
Wow.
Every year.
That's amazing.
So it's an amazing amount of paper. And so if you close your eyes and imagine a digital world for the judicial branch, and we reduced that paper to significantly to zero, zeroed that paper need out, there's some inherent cost savings in doing that, and both from a workflow and just from what I would call hard dollars as well. You know, that paper costs money, and so, but to replace that with the digital system also costs money. Now, I think there are some efficiencies that can be inherently absorbed in the judicial branch, and so I think before we would run down and say, write us a check for $100 million so we can make make the judicial branch more efficient. I think there's some what I would call year zero type projects that we can help, and we've started those, and that's I pointed those a couple of those out earlier,
right,
when we were talking about online collection and payment,
sure,
and electronic compliance and dismissal, and so some of those efforts are already underway to help reduce that, to make our branch efficient and make a better case on what kind of savings we can produce by doing things digitally.
Well, Tom, you've been very informative, and I can remember when I worked at the General Assembly, they were transitioning at that time from paper to digital for the members, not to have a bill reprinted out every time it was changed, and I know there's been great cost savings there, so hopefully perhaps the judicial branch will be able to enjoy some of that enhancement in technology also. I really appreciate you coming on the show today, Tom. You're an excellent guest, and I think you've helped our listeners understand a little bit more about what goes on in the day-to-day operation and needs for the very important judicial branch of government in our state.
It was a pleasure, Mark, and look forward to being with you once again.
All right. Thanks, Tom. Have a great day.
You too. Take care. Bye.
All right. Well, that was kind of fun, finding out a little bit about what the Administrative Office of the Courts does. And, boy, they have a lot of employees. I certainly did not know that. So, interestingly enough, we mentioned this briefly yesterday as breaking news, but Rowan County Commissioners, again, will be allowed to pray at the beginning of their meetings. A Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals panel overturned a decision by a Greensboro federal judge that said they couldn't do that, and they said that this Christian invocation that county leaders used to open their sessions did not violate the separation of church and state. So interesting for those folks down in Rowan County that wanted to have this. And you know, so many city councils, town councils, county commissions, they just open their meetings with a word of prayer, and it's really not a big deal until somebody wants to make it a big deal, and then they have to go through the court system to try to get validation for doing that. And in a nation that was, you know, founded upon basically freedom of religion, I think that we should be thankful that the court rendered this decision. There are so many who want to do away with religious liberty, religious freedom. You know, I told you last week about the Civil Rights Commission saying that religious liberty and religious freedom are code for homophobia, Islamophobia, you know, any other phobia that you can think of. It's code for the right to discriminate, which there's nothing further from the truth. Just because you happen to be a person of faith or a person who believes in religious liberty and freedom in no way is indicative of having a desire to discriminate against other people. Well, thanks for listening today. Enjoyed having our guests, Susan Myrick, and of course, Hans von Spakovsky and Tom Murray. Hope you'll listen to us again tomorrow, and tell your friends to be sure to check us out on the Freedom Action Network, also in the iTunes and Google Play Store. Thanks for listening to What Matters in North Carolina.